And the very first one is that bad stuff happens with no warning. And I think that's one of the key learnings that's come out of COVID-19. I wonder if you can remember January of this year. It's only 5 or 6 months ago. So it's 6 months ago. And it just seems like a different world. It seems a very, very long time ago. But life was just entirely different then. I think we were different. We've been changed by this COVID experience. And if you go back to January, then we just had no inkling that this was coming. Now, I know that there have been people like Lance Jennings, who's a virologist in Christchurch, has been saying for years and years, decades actually, that there would be another pandemic. But we certainly weren't expecting to be locked out of our businesses and locked into our houses, all of us, anytime soon. So bad stuff happens and it comes out of the blue. I think one of the things that has exacerbated this to some extent is that we have been very used and very used to good times. We've had a decade of very good economic times, and we're a little bit out of practice for enduring bad economic times. Somebody of my age, or somebody in their 50s even, will have seen some recessions, whereas people in their 20s and 30s who are watching this may never before have seen a recession because they were still at university perhaps when the GFC hit. And, you know, I think it's a key, this is an absolute key learning. And what it says to me is that people need to remember that bad stuff happens. It can happen completely out of the blue, and you need to have your finances ready for that. There's a couple of major points that I want to make go in just a moment as to what those points should be. But I think you've always got to expect at some point that things could suddenly turn bad. The second learning that I think we need to take out of this, and I don't have any slide for it, I racked my brain to get one. The only thing I could come up with something which was either a bit silly or a bit naff. But the learning I think here is that we all need some emergency money. I've been astonished at the number of people I've heard of who just had nothing to come and go on. Now, as it turned out, because governments around the world, and certainly the government in New Zealand, stepped in and made sure nobody was going without, then nobody actually went hungry. But we all need to have some emergency money. Those who are watching this and who are in work, they should know that the financial planning benchmark is that you should at all times hold about 3 months equivalent of cash to get you through. That is, whatever you would be spending on a normal quarter, a normal 3 months, you should hold that amount in cash. I'd say for retired people, in fact, the plans I've always done, financial plans I've always done for retired people, I've always had at least a year and possibly as much as 2 years of cash tucked away to tide them over. And what I'd always say to retired people is that you need that amount of cash because you really want, you know, they're living off their savings, they're drawing out of their investment portfolios. You really want to be in a situation where you don't have to draw on the portfolio if markets are down. And hopefully, you know, markets could be down for longer than a year or two, but hopefully not. So if you had a year or maybe 2 years equivalent of cash tucked away, then you could get through a downturn without having to draw on the portfolio. Now, I know that when I'm talking about cash, I'm really talking about term deposits or bank savings accounts. And I know that that pays a very low return now. So people will say to me, you know, but there's no return on that. That money's not working. My answer to that is that's the price you pay for safety. So it's a little bit like insurance, for example. You insure your house, you pay a price, you hope the house, you expect the house won't burn down, but just in case it does, you have a cost, you have a price for insuring the house. And we think that's sensible, and I think it's sensible to tuck away some emergency money. So when I talked before about always being ready for a downturn, having some cash tucked away that will tide you over for a period, that's one of them.
Sorry to interrupt. If you enjoy this content, make sure you subscribe so you do not miss the next one, and hit this like button to let me know that you want more information like this. Thank you.
The third thing, third learning that I think we need to take heed of is that stimulus works. Right around the world, certainly in New Zealand, but right around the world, governments have pumped money into economies, huge amounts of money, trillions and trillions of dollars. And you know, they've done that, and it's been necessary, and it's been really good. They're printing money as we speak, and they will be borrowing money into the quite a way into the distant future. Now, central banks around the world have had a big part in this. You know, it is the central banks that run monetary policy. They have been printing money. There's an old investment saying which says, "Don't fight the Fed." In other words, don't try to fight the central bank. Don't take an investment stance which is against the Federal Reserve or against the central bank. And what these people are saying is that when a central bank, or when central banks generally, are pumping huge amounts of money into global economies, that's almost certainly going to be very good for shares, and shares are going to go up. So don't fight against that likelihood. So don't take too negative a view. This is something, to be honest, which I have got wrong, and I'll come back to that later, but markets fell hugely back in March. They've bounced, and I have been expecting further waves of selling. They haven't happened. I've been trying to fight the Fed, and the Fed wins. The Fed and markets have carried on upwards. But I think we learned this in the GFC. Governments around the world pumped quite a lot of money into economies. With COVID, governments around the world have pumped huge amounts, not you know, far beyond what happened in 2009, 2010. And that's what has kept us going. There'll be a price for that. I'm not quite sure how that's going to play out, but maybe I could at some stage have a really good look at that. I think we'll have to wait 6 months, maybe 12 months, to see how that does play out. The fourth thing, and I think this again goes back to that you have to be ready for a downturn at any time. And the fourth thing is, make sure that you are taking the right level of risk. So in KiwiSaver terms, make sure that you're in the right fund, you know, be that conservative growth or balanced. I said those around different ways. You know, growth fund with lots of shares, balanced fund with about 50% shares, conservative fund with a small amount of shares. You've got to be in the right fund. We saw going back in March, when we had that very steep fall in share markets around the world, we saw a lot of people who were rattled out of the market. That is, they were so frightened, they couldn't put up with the volatility, and they sold out. And a lot of them would have sold out right into the bottom of that, and that would have been extremely, extremely bad for them. So what you've got to think about is to try and get into a fund with as much risk as you can possibly tolerate. I know that this is a bad thing to try to judge, particularly when we've had 10 years of very benign economic climate, and all of a sudden something like that comes along. So yes, it is quite difficult to judge, but you can go online, you can go to Sorted, or Summer KiwiSaver has one of these calculators that allow you to answer half a dozen questions, and they'll tell you what sort of fund you should be in. There's two main factors that these questionnaires are asking about. One is the amount of time you've got. So if you're 40 and there's 25 years to retirement, all else being equal, you should be in a growth or an aggressive fund. If you are 62 and you're going to retire in 65 years, in 3 years at age 65, then you would be in a more conservative, maybe a balanced fund, something like that. So that's one factor, the amount of time. The other factor is your psychological makeup. You know, some people just worry about their money and they can't tolerate the idea of watching their hard-earned savings diminish in value. And these are the people who get rattled out of the market. I think I'm working from memory, I should have looked it up beforehand, but I think something like $1.6 billion in KiwiSaver went from a growth or aggressive fund down to a balanced or conservative fund. Now that's an awful lot of money. One of the worst things that can happen to you as an investor is that you become a forced seller, because forced sales is almost always at a time of market downturn. Now forced sellers are usually for two reasons. One is that you need the cash, because there's a recession or something like that, so you end up selling some investments right at the wrong time. The second one is that you get rattled out of the market. That is, you get so frightened that and so I guess almost seasick from the ups and downs of the volatility, that you get forced out of the market. Next one, and this is number five, is really concerns interest rates. Again, if you put your mind back to January, there were a lot of people folding their arms and saying to me, interest rates are very low. There's only one way for interest rates. That is, interest rates are going to go back up. You know, the only way for interest rates is that they're going to higher. Well, interest rates, you know, were low then, or they felt like they were low, but of course they can always be lower. And one of the difficulties I think we have with this is that we get anchored to what we've become used to. And you know, if you take somebody my age, but even somebody significantly younger, we've been very used to and therefore become anchored to interest rates which are much higher. So to try to show this, to display this, I've actually pulled out a graph that I've used often actually, and it shows interest rates over really the last couple of hundred years, so starting in 1790. And if you cast your eye across that, you know, you go to the left-hand column, which is the interest rate, you can see that the average interest rate over that sort of period of time was probably around 4%. But, you know, people my age and a bit younger, people in their 50s, maybe even younger than that, were very used to interest rates at 9-10%. A lot of people my age will tell you about how they had a mortgage at 20%+, and I certainly did. But if that's what we've lived through, and if that's what we've spent 30 odd years having, that's what we become anchored to. And if you look at that graph and you go to the right hand side of it, you see the period of the 1970s, 80s and 90s. And that 30 odd year period was actually, we thought that interest rates were normal. But if you look at the graph, they are abnormal. That is, those very high interest rates were an aberration really compared to previously in history. And so we get anchored to 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12% interest rates, and we're disgusted at interest rates at 3%, which was back a couple of months ago, a few months ago, or a couple of years ago, but we're even more disgusted with what they are now. Now, of course, there's always a split with interest rates. Some people want low interest rates. You know, if you were a homeowner, you had a mortgage, then you want low interest rates. I don't. I want high interest rates because I'm an investor and I don't have any borrowings, so I'd like interest rates to be as high as possible. I think for me to get my way, it could be a very long wait. So the key thing on that graph is how the period that I lived through, which was quite formative for me, the 70s, 80s and 90s, interest rates were very high, but that was the aberration. Now, I showed that graph once at a seminar I was doing, and I was talking like that, and Bernard Hickey was one of the fellow speakers, and Bernard, to go one better, told me of another graph and showed me another graph, and I managed to get that graph. And this is a graph of interest rates over the last 5,000 years. So the Bank of England did this and used all sorts of sources to get their information. But the important thing there is not what did interest rates do when Julius Caesar was assassinated, or I don't know, the Great Armada appeared off the British coastline. The important thing is, again, if you go to the right-hand part of that, in my period, in our period, and you know, our interest rates were an aberration. Unless you go right back to 3000 BC, where interest rates, for some reason, were extremely high. I don't know why that was. I doubt anybody knows why that was. You can see that, again, our period is the aberration. And I think the learning out of this for me is that interest rates can go lower. They can always go lower because we can go into negative interest rates. A third of the OECD, this is a year or two ago, had negative interest rates. So, you know, we're pretty well practiced at having negative interest rates, but that they're not going to return to what I would have regarded as normal, in other words 7, 8, 9%. They're not going to go back to that anytime soon. In fact, every indicator, everything I read, would suggest that interest rates are going to stay even lower for even longer. Next one's one that I covered really in a pretty much a whole webinar, and that is that crises create either new trends or they accelerate existing trends. You know, if one of the trends which has caught me a little bit by surprise is the number of Kiwis who have decided during COVID to come home. I believe there's something like 45,000 of them already, and they're coming home, and that's causing a mini property boom in many property markets around the country. Not in all, but in certainly in some. Here in Christchurch, which is where I live now, we're certainly seeing that. And I heard of an auctioneer who the other day had 8 houses to auction in a day, 6 of them sold under the hammer. So something is happening here, and part of it will be immigration, these people returning home. Something is happening that people have come out of lockdown and they're buying houses. So that's kind of a new trend. Now, when these people have come home, and assuming our borders are still closed, then the property markets could turn around a lot. And also at the same time, there may be an increasing number of people become unemployed or people who lose their businesses as the government support programs become smaller. So that's one thing, that new trends appear. And one of the things I'd say to you with this is to watch for this, to try to play it from an investment point of view. But I did a webinar, I think it was the second or the third one, in which I basically talked about the trends which were being accelerated. And I was talking there of things like artificial intelligence, tech generally, things like Netflix, that whole work to home thing, which they've been there in the background. They were a bit of a trend, but they've been accelerated by COVID. I'm never sure when I look at that photo, and I've used that photo a few times now, because there's no kids trying to dance on the breakfast bar, and there's no dirty dishes in the sink anywhere, and everything looks very sane. I'm quite sure that there are a lot of people who, when they were working from home, weren't in quite the peaceful surroundings that lady's ended up in. The seventh one is, it's a question of time, really. And I guess my way of putting that would be that train wrecks happen in slow motion. I've never really had a major car accident, but the one or two little scrapes I've had, I remember clearly the way everything slowed down. And people who've had major car accidents say that it's a really key part of it. Everything seems to happen in slow motion, and it's, you know, in some ways it's like this whole COVID thing, or at least the economic ramifications of COVID are happening in slow motion. And although we've had this now for what, 4 months or something like that, it doesn't mean it's gone. I love that those of you who remember Julius Caesar, the play by Shakespeare, there's that line where the soothsayer is told, he's been predicting that Caesar would die on the Ides of March, and soothsayer fronts up to Hitler and to Caesar, and Caesar says, well, the Ides are come, and the soothsayer says back, but not yet gone. And it's like that at the moment. I almost feel, I put this to Shamabeel as well, that we're in a phony war sort of situation. They feel a bit normal, but things feel like they're happening very slowly. Often these big economic changes take a long period of time to play out. So the crash of 1929, which I am too young to remember, I'm delighted to say, the crash of 1929, it happened on one day for a start off, but the worst of it wasn't for some months or even years later, and that carried on for a very long period of time. Shamabeel said at the session we did 2 or 3 weeks ago that he thought we were at the start of the second phase. I'm not sure whether he's got a third phase, probably does, and that might be when government support goes off and that sort of thing. I guess what I'm making here, the learning, is that these things take a long time to play out, and it's almost like it's happening in slow motion. Everybody I know talks about how they can hardly remember what it was like back in January or February, that just seems a lifetime ago. It seems a very long time ago. So, and the final one that I need to talk about is, we never know the future. Now, I'm a very active fund manager. Summer KiwiSaver, the investment committee that I chair, is a very active manager. I personally am quite active with my own investments, but you have to acknowledge that sometimes you get on the wrong side of things. So if we go back to perhaps March, when we were having that severe volatility downturn of the market of maybe 40%, I expected further waves of selling. Not necessarily that it would go a lot lower than 40%, but that it would certainly go lower. And I've used this graph that's on the on your screen at the moment, because it that shows the 2009, the GFC, how there were about five major waves, five or six really, major waves of selling until the market bottomed out. That was the kind of thing that I was expecting. Actually, this is what happened. So mid-March, I think the 20, sorry, early March, we started to see that very sharp fall. Mid-March, it bottomed. It started coming up. I expected, as it was coming up, for there to be waves of selling and for it to retest that low. That is, for it to fall back to about that low, or maybe even lower. And I was expecting it to do that. For there to be further waves of selling. So, I was reasonably well cashed up, and I was looking to become a strong buyer into some of these waves of selling, some of these major falls. They never actually happened. The pattern, as you can see from that graph really clearly, since I think the 23rd of March, something like that, the pattern has been just upwards and onwards, driven, of course, by all this money that's being pumped into economies by central banks around the world. So you've got there what looks like a V-shaped recovery. I thought it would be W. Now, that's not to say, and I've still got a fair bit of cash in the bank to say this with, but that's not to say that there may not yet be further waves of selling. We don't know what. We don't know absolutely what is around the corner. And you can argue that that shares in particular are very highly valued. Fixed interest investments, bonds are similarly highly valued. So you could argue that even now there could still be further waves of selling, but I don't think they'll be as sharp nor as deep as what we have. So it is just possible that this time is different. We're not going to have multiple waves of selling. We've had one big wave of selling, and after that there was mostly a recovery with the odd little technical correction going on within it. So we always have to have some doubt. We don't have perfect prescience. We don't perfectly know what the future's going to be. I can't imagine what it would take for me to go 100% in cash. Somebody said to me a couple of months ago, if we had perfect prescience, we would either be 100% in shares or 100% in cash. So if we thought things were going to get better, the market was going to go up, we would be 100% in shares. If we thought that there was going to be a fall, we would be 100% in cash. The fact that we don't know is why we have different asset allocations. So we allocate our money to lots of different asset classes because we can never be quite sure. We can take a view that we think the markets are going to fall again, and therefore we can weight our portfolios more heavily towards cash, but we can't really ever say, I am absolutely certain of this. When we were in pretty much the bottom of that V, I thought to myself, I am, and as the market started climbing up the other side, I thought to myself, I am 95% sure that we're going to get another fall. But no longer, maybe I'm getting to be a certain age or something, no longer would I say I'm 100% sure of this, so I'm going to have 100% of my money in just one asset class. So I'm going to stop there and see if Helen's got any questions.
Thanks, Martin. That's great. Yes, I do. You might need your crystal ball for a few of them. But let's start first talking about for first-time investors. So for a first-time investor in the share market who doesn't have a lot of money to invest, so probably wouldn't be worth or wouldn't be considered by a financial advisor. How do they start, and where would they get advice and information from as to how to proceed, to go with something like Sharesies or?
My understanding, I'm a big supporter of Sharesies. I think what they've done is great. They've now got $500 million of a lot of small investors' money. What I'm not sure of is how much independent advice they are able to give their people, whether they are doing and putting out research to their clients. I guess the first thing I would say is that if you have a bit more money, so if you had a few thousand dollars, you might get a share broker who would take that money for you and not invest it for you, but invest it with you, so that you would identify three or four companies that you could buy. You would get the research that the share broker would no doubt have, read that, understand why you're doing it, and work with him or her far as you possibly can. And I think again, if it's a younger person, and most of the Sharesies people are young, then that I hope you get good learning and good education, and that stands you in very good stead for the rest of your life. If you are, however, going to be a Sharesies investor because you simply don't have enough money to approach somebody and get advice or research, then you simply have to do as much of the research as you possibly can. Now, there are plenty of books, there are plenty of articles, there's plenty of information online now that you can get. One thing that I would suggest that people do is learn how a price earnings ratio works, and how that values any share that you're looking at buying, and to be able to figure out what the price earnings ratio of a company is yourself. This is not high flying or difficult maths, nor are the concepts particularly difficult, but I think share investing, as indeed property investing, as indeed fixed interest investment, all comes back to a measure of how much income are you going to get from this investment, and therefore what price will you pay for it. And so it's a price to earnings ratio that you're actually looking at. Property does exactly the same. The language, the jargon changes. It's called capitalization rate, but again, it's much the same sort of thing. We are saying, is that a reasonable amount of income? Is that income going to grow over time, as in the case of property, as rents increase, as in the case of shares, as the company increases? And my final bit of advice on a Sharesies investor who's left by herself or himself is to think about the company you're owning, the business that you're owning, as if you were going to buy the whole business. Now, I do this with any share that I buy. I sit down, I think I've said this before on these webinars, but I'm going to say it again because I think it's really important. So I sit back and say, well, if I had $5 billion, would I buy all of Ryman Healthcare? And if the answer to that, I don't have $5 billion, by the way, and if the answer to that was no, I wouldn't, then what on earth am I doing in buying a small share in it? So you're really boiling this down to the fact that on the share market, you are buying a small part of a business. And you've just got to look at that business as if you would own it. And so there's an element of common sense in there. You know what does the business do? How does it make its money? Do you like that? Is there a good business model there that looks like it will make money in the future? Because all you're doing is looking for a stream of profits from the business, and then putting seeing if the price on the share market is reasonable for that. That was much longer than what I intended to go for, but I'm really concerned that there are a lot of people going into sharesies who are speculating and are just guessing what companies might do. And I really hope this does not turn out badly for people and that it puts people off the share market.
That's great. Thanks, Martin. Okay. A question we had earlier from Terry saying, as a retiree, should I have savings in a conservative fund or more aggressive or a mix? Does that come back to your comfort levels with risk?
It does come. It comes back to two things. First of all, you know, a retired person today, say in their late 60s, they're likely, you know, if it's a she, they're likely to be retired for 25 years. You know, she's likely to live to early 90s. If it's a he, he's likely to live to late 80s, or something like that. So it's a fairly long period of time, which means that you can afford to be a bit more in a balanced portfolio. Then I wouldn't say an aggressive one for that person, but you might go to balanced. It then really comes down to psychological makeup. What we've got to try and do here is get a happy fit between the person and their money. So it's no point taking a lot more risk and being miserably scared. Because A, you'll make some bad decisions, but B, you shouldn't be living your life in fear. So I would really encourage that person to find one of these weed calculator things, answer the half a dozen questions, and that should give you a fairly good indication as to what level of risk is reasonable for you. And by all means, do more than one of them. So, you know, you can go on to various sites. If I was doing it for a client, I'd go on to the Summer site and I'd go on to Sorted. And I might even try and find a third one somewhere, maybe even an overseas one, just to give a bit of a spread and just see what they came out at. They should all be much of a muchness, but just see if one came out differently.
Thanks, Martin. I'm conscious that we are now at 5:15. We do have a number of questions, so I think the idea of the webinar for questions might be a good one.
Let's have a couple more, Helen.
Okay. All right. Question then about investments in gold, metals, Bitcoin, and cryptocurrencies.
Okay, so I don't see any of those as investments. I don't think you can invest in gold or you can't invest in cryptocurrency, because for something technically to be an investment, it must give you a return, which is not simply a return based on a change in price. So if you buy gold, you get no income from gold. You can only make money if the value of gold goes up. And you are therefore, in a technical sense, and Maynard Keynes and Benjamin Graham did a lot of work in this area. You're really, if you buy gold, you are speculating on a change in value. Bare land, similarly, unless it's used for farming. So for something to be an investment, it must give a return, a cash return, which you know, doesn't mean that you're not also looking for a capital gain. You are, but you are getting a return for something to be an investment. And when you come down to it, there are only There are only four things that will give you a cash return. One is shares or business. Second is, and that gives a return through their profits. Second is property, and that gives you a return through rent. Third is fixed interest or bonds, and you're getting an interest return on that. And cash, you're getting a pitiful but return, but you are still getting a return. They're the only things that give you a that are the only assets that you can buy that will give you a cash return. And they are the only four investments that you can make. All these other things, let's call them what they are. You can speculate on them, you can't invest in them. So, and, you know, to say, is Bitcoin going to go up? I don't know. Whereas I can say, is Amazon going to go up? Well, if Amazon can and continue to increase its profits, then yes, its share price should carry on going upwards. So it's a completely different thing than speculating on a future price movement of a commodity that bears no income.
Great, thanks, Martin. Okay, question about the share market now. You might need your crystal ball for this one, from Chris. So Chris says he recently read an article suggesting that we can expect 4% inflation by the end of next year. If this did occur, what would you expect the share market would do?
You'd have to, first of all, I'd really question that 4% inflation by the end of next year. I cannot see that happening. I know Shamabil Jakob was the same 2 or 3 weeks ago. We should be lucky. Our big fear is deflation, that is prices actually falling, because that is very hard to get rid of. As Japan has found over the last 30 years, they've had periods of deflation that's hard to get rid of. If we had 4% inflation, my guess is that means that things are going very well in this country. That is, businesses feel that they are able to put their prices up, and therefore we're getting that kind of inflation. So I would actually say the share market would probably be doing quite well. There might be a bit of a lag. We might have the inflation. And Reserve Bank therefore starts putting up interest rates, and that holds the share market down. But if we've got 4% inflation, that means that things are going pretty well, which is because it's allowing businesses are doing so well that they're feeling that they are able to put their prices up. Just one more thing. I haven't read the article that the person has. And I don't know who it's by or what it's saying or anything like that. But people said there was a fair bit of money printing and a fair bit of government borrowing back in the GFC 2009, 2010. And people said, with all this extra money that's been printed and extra money that's been borrowed, we are bound, we are certain to have more inflation. It never happened. We haven't had a lot of inflation in the last decade, and yet a lot of money was printed. Now, there's even, as I said earlier, there's even more money being printed right at the moment, and maybe this time it's all different. But there's no inflation on my horizon for the foreseeable future that I can see. And I read, just sort of going one better in a way, not really, but I think it was an Economist article. Certainly something I read not you know in the last few days, which was talking about no inflation for 30 years. Now, who knows, but over that period of time, but I certainly don't see 4% by the end of next year. One more, Helen.
Okay. All right. Final question we'll ask about KiwiSaver. So should we be looking at our KiwiSaver? And if so, what information is available to be able to compare how different KiwiSaver schemes are performing? So how do we know whether we're in the right or the best scheme? And what sort of variation is there in fees amongst the schemes? Can we find that?
Yeah, no, this is one of the hardest things for people. We've got 3 million investors in New Zealand now who are KiwiSaver members, and it's very hard to get this kind of information. One thing that comes out quarterly is the Morningstar KiwiSaver survey. If you put Morningstar KiwiSaver survey into Google or a search engine, it will tell you, it will link you to it. Now, I think it was only last week they came out with their quarterly survey, and in each risk category, so for conservative, for balanced, for growth and so forth, they list all of the funds and the returns that they had over the last month, the last quarter, the last year, the last 3 years, the last 5 years, and the last 10 years. So you can look at that and you can say, that's the return that ABC got, that's the return that CDE got. And they also have who is the best in each category. So one, they go, you know, one through to 25. Fees vary quite a lot, but don't get too far.